Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Julian Chang, your moderator for tonight's program, Mormons for Marriage Equality, featuring Mitch Main. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members here tonight. We know that you will enjoy your membership, and we hope that you come a lot and often. I'd also like to tell our new members, as well as our guests, about some programs that we have coming up. I invite each and every one of you to participate in some of our programs, especially in the topics in which you have a specific expertise or interest. So please mark your calendars now for these upcoming programs, which are special. Next week, on October 18th, Ted Olson will be here reflecting on Prop 8. Mr. Olson has argued many cases before the Supreme Court and has a 75% winning average before the Supreme Court, and one of his cases right now is before the Supreme Court, the Prop 8 case. And then on November 28, Truvada, Can a Pill Prevent HIV, featuring Dr. Robert Grant and Health Commissioner Cecilia Chung. These are just two of the many programs that will be upcoming, brought to you by the member-led forums here at the Commonwealth Club. I invite you to pick up a copy of our printed brochure that's available in the lobby, as well as going to our website, commonwealthclub.org, where every moment of the day you can see what is up and current as far as our programming that is coming up. There are question cards on your seat. I ask that you please write your questions for tonight's speaker on them and bring them up to me. Your questions will be asked during the question and answer period. And we are recording today's program for possible broadcast on radio, as well as podcast on the club's website. So please turn off all your cell phones or pagers right now and enjoy the program. In November 2008, Proposition 8 was passed by the voters of California, taking away the right of same-sex people to get married under the law in California. Since then, the issue has been in litigation. Many post-vote analyses blamed various entities, including the Mormon Church, for bankrolling and actively supporting Prop 8. Accusations were made and grudges were formed on both sides of the issue. Now, 4 years later, the world is a vastly different place. The anti-gay policy of don't ask, don't tell has been repealed with no ill effects to America's military. The president is openly in support of marriage equality and has instructed the Department of Justice to no longer defend the Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage as only between one man and one woman, substantially the same terms as Proposition 8. There are now six states, plus the District of Columbia, which grant full marriage equality rights to all. 11 countries around the world grant legal recognition to same-sex marriages. California itself has a different governor who now supports full marriage equality. In the midst of all this change, has the Mormon Church changed too? And what about the LGBT community? Has there been an evolution in the community towards people of faith who are also queer? Today, October 11th, is National Coming Out Day. It is especially appropriate that tonight we examine what changes have happened in the realm of marriage equality and the intersection between what it means to be gay and a person of faith. I'm delighted that our guest tonight is Mitch Main. Mitch Main is an openly gay, active Latter-day Saint. He currently serves as executive secretary for the bishopric of the LDS Church in San Francisco. In addition to the formal duties of his calling, Mitch works to build bridges between the LGBT and Mormon communities and speaks and writes publicly about his experiences as an openly gay Mormon. He works in a corporate communication department for a Fortune 100 firm, and he lives in San Francisco. Welcome, Mitch Main.
Thank you, Julian. So earlier this week, I was talking to Julian about just simple logistics for tonight, and I asked him if there was going to be a cordless mic, and he said, "What?" And I said, "Yes, a cordless mic." And he said, "You know, in all my years of doing this, I have never had anyone request a cordless mic because everybody wants to hide behind the podium." Well, not to be one to shirk off a compliment, I thanked him for recognizing my bravery, but the reality is I'm a secret Diet Coke junkie, so by 6 p.m. in the evening, I'm usually so over-caffeinated that I'd probably be dragging that thing around the floor with me tonight. I want to start tonight by doing a couple things. First and foremost is to let you know that I am not a professional paid spokesperson of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I am here tonight as Mitch Main, an openly gay Mormon, and I'm going to share my own story, my own experience, strength, and hope with you around the subject of the LGBT and Mormon communities. And I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about my story, but then I want to talk about some of the things that we've accomplished in the past 14 months since I have been in my calling, because I think the real interesting story here is not me, but what is actually happening and what's transforming in the communities themselves. So as far as a little contextual history background for me, I was raised in Idaho. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Idaho, we in the Mormon community refer to Idaho as being more Utah than Utah. It is very conservative politically, and it was a rather difficult climate to grow up in as a gay Mormon. One of the questions that I often get asked is, when did you first know that you were gay? And when I first got asked that, I didn't really know how to respond, because quite honestly, I didn't ever know that I wasn't gay. One of my favorite stories to tell is when I was in first grade at age 6, I would go to class, and then my school, we'd get out at 3 in the afternoon. And I would rush home from school at 3 o'clock. I wouldn't go to my friend's house to play. I wouldn't stop to play on the playground. But I would beat feet home because at 4 o'clock, there were reruns of the original Star Trek series. And I had such a horrible crush on Captain Kirk. Yes, James Tiberius Kirk was my very first crush. And I didn't have the vocabulary to be able to tell you what I was feeling. There was nothing sexual about it. It was just, I knew that I liked watching this handsome guy who darted around the galaxy and fought for what was right. And he was noble, and he was valiant, and he was honest. And did I say handsome? And he was also handsome. And, you know, I just wanted that quality in my life. I just wanted James Tiberius Kirk in my life. And Captain Kirk would have been the man that I would have chosen to give my first grade Valentine to. So I always knew that I was gay, even before I had the words to be able to put a label on it. Now, as I grew up and I started realizing what society taught about that and, you know, what my church taught about that, I became obviously very walled up emotionally about my sexual orientation and didn't share it much. And it was a pretty miserable existence. I heard the messages from society and from my church that, you know, that's not who God wants you to be. God hates gay people. You know, you shouldn't be gay. You're making this choice. And, you know, all the other messages that we hear as LGBT Mormons or LGBT people as a whole. And I bought into that. I bought into that for a really long time, and I believed those tapes, and I played them to myself over and over again. At age 16, when I finally had the courage to come out to my parents essentially did absolutely everything that parents are not supposed to do when a child comes out. My mom's first words to me when I came out to her were, "It would have been easier for me if you had been born dead than gay." And that really cut me. It wasn't until years later that I realized that those were not the words of a mom who hated her gay son. Those were just the words of a Mormon mom who didn't know how to help him. So fast forward, living through Idaho, managing to get out for college, ending up here in graduate school in Palo Alto. After graduate school in Palo Alto, I moved over to the East Bay, over into the Oakland Hills area, and I had had a pretty tormented past with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and my sexual orientation. I told a variety of bishops off and on throughout my tenure that I was gay, and without fail, I was met with a hard shove back into the closet with, you know, don't tell anybody. I'm not going to excommunicate you now, but if I hear about it again, I might. So it was a very tormented history with the Mormon Church. So I was in and out of church for a number of years, and I just didn't really feel like I fit. Well, when I got to the Oakland First Ward up in the Oakland Hills, it was kind of a different story. Oakland really is this unique little enclave of, you know, liberal thought and progressive people who don't find offense in asking questions and don't think it's wrong to look at things differently and to think about things differently. And I almost immediately found a home there. During that same time period, I met and fell in love with my partner. And we were together for a number of years. Most everybody in my ward, my congregation, knew that I was gay. I wore a wedding band. Many of my cohorts in the Mormon community actually knew my partner. I held a calling. I taught Sunday school. I had a really, really awesome Mormon life. An awesome Mormon life that pretty much only straight people in Utah get to experience. I don't know of any gay member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that had the same opportunity that I had when I was in Oakland. And then Proposition 8 hit. Proposition 8 was very difficult for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it was difficult for me as a gay Mormon to sit in church and listen to some of my brothers and sisters inside my own faith lobby for a public policy issue that would essentially keep me from marrying the man that I loved. It was also made difficult by looking at some of my other brothers and sisters inside the faith who grappled with what this meant to be a Mormon and didn't appreciate it and didn't like it and didn't support it. I also watched as many of my straight counterparts left the church, not just here in the Bay Area, but all across the country, in Idaho, in Utah, in Montana, in New York. But I think the most difficult impact for me was what happened in my home as a result of the Mormon Church's involvement in Proposition 8. That involvement became a real issue in my relationship with my partner, and it began to essentially erode the underpinning of trust and love that we had for one another. And I do believe in my heart of hearts that the Mormon Church's Proposition 8 involvement was one of the key reasons that my relationship with a man that I have loved more than anyone in the world dissolved. I would not allow my church to tell me who I can and cannot marry, but I will also not allow my partner to tell me how I can and cannot practice my faith. To do either of those things would make me disingenuous. So over time, that relationship ended. Proposition 8 also ended. And what I was able to do, because I was Mormon, was actually seek solace, and because I was open about who I was actually seek solace with my counterparts inside the Mormon Church. And I actually sought one of my priesthood leaders out and talked to him, just like I'm talking to you guys here today, and was able, as a gay man, to sit down and explain myself to him how I felt and to be heard and to be validated. And he actually gave me a priesthood blessing of comfort. That's something gay Mormons who go through divorce just don't get, but they should. At the same time that all of this was happening, I got a call from my stake president, who is he's a leader in the Mormon faith that actually oversees many wards or many congregations. I got a call from my stake president in Oakland, and he said, "Hey, you know, I'm actually putting together a little group, a speaking bureau, if you will, to talk about Proposition 8 and to kind of, again, to build the fences or to build the bridges between the Mormon and LGBT communities. And I want to roll this out to the congregations in the East Bay. Will you be part of this? I know that you've been writing for a while about, you know, your experiences as a gay Mormon. Will you help?" And of course, I completely agreed. And I think over the course of about 14 months, we had well over a dozen events, stretching out all the way from Oakland and Berkeley, clear out into Davis. And What I learned in that 14-month period was this is a really, really important topic. And it's not just important to LGBT people. It's important to straight Mormons and to the straight community as a whole. It's like, for example, we had one event in Berkeley, and we were expecting about 60 people, and 300 showed up. And that would happen over and over and over again, and it really showed the need in the community for this type of conversation to begin taking place. So during that same time period, I had moved over to the city with my partner, was actually residing in San Francisco. And my stake president from Oakland called me again, and he said, hey, you know what? The San Francisco stake presidency wants to meet, and they want you to go, and they want to kind of talk about what we're doing over here in Oakland and see if they can kind of replicate it in the San Francisco area. Would you be interested in going? And I was, you know, in the throes of going through, you know, the breakup of my relationship, and I said, sure, what the heck, I'll go. And I walked into this meeting, and I met this guy named Don Fletcher. Now, it was a meeting probably of about 20, 25 people, and I think the only two people who really talked a lot were both me and Don. We're two people who are, you know, very hard to shut up, apparently. And as we spent that evening together with these other people, we talked about the ways that Oakland had really done a great job of beginning to open this dialogue and what San Francisco could do to do the same thing. Now, at this time, Don actually served as part of the San Francisco stake presidency here in the city. And so we stayed in touch after the meeting and talked off and on. And one day, a couple weeks later, I was at the gym. And it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I remember this distinctly. And I get a phone call. And I look down at my phone, and it's Don Fletcher. And so I pick up the phone, and I'm like, you know, hey, Don, how you doing? And he's like, I'm good. Hey, what are you doing at 5 o'clock? Can you meet me at my office? It's up on Fillmore Street by your house. And I said, well, I can, but I'm at the gym, and I don't really have a change of clothes, and I'm, you know, not exactly April fresh. Is that a problem? And he's like, no. It's no problem at all. I want you to show up. I absolutely want you to show up. You just be there at 5. I don't care what you're wearing. So I went ahead and went. So I'm driving up to the Fillmore, and I'm really self-conscious because I really am just off the treadmill. And I walk up to Don's very nice ophthalmology office, and he's in his suit, and, you know, he escorts me through the building. And the minute we got a moment alone, I knew what he was going to ask me. He sat me down and said, you know, I'm going to be called as the bishop of the Bay Ward, which is actually the ward in which you physically reside. So I'm going to be the bishop in this ward, and I want you to serve with me. Will you do it? And I had to think. I had a really, really blessed Mormon life. I was honored. I was loved. I was acknowledged and accepted for exactly who I was as a gay Mormon. Did I want to give all of that up and walk away from that in the hopes of maybe being able to create that for other LGBT Mormons? I really had to think. But I said, yes. Yes, I will. And that is how I came to be in this position. So a year ago, last August, I was sustained as executive secretary to the bishopric in the San Francisco Bay Ward here in San Francisco, California. But I want to talk quickly about some of the things that have happened in that 14 months, because I think these are very inspiring and very important. We have seen the emergence in the past 14 months of a Mormon LGBT conference called Circling the Wagons. It has taken place in 4 different locations now around the country. And what this conference does is brings together LGBT Mormons, the LGBT community, and straight Mormons, and helps them understand how LGBT Mormons fit within our faith. Pretty unprecedented to have the Mormon community sponsor something like that. For the first time in history, we have seen LGBT Mormons and straight Mormons march in pride celebrations. Think about that. Mormons marching in pride celebrations in almost 20 cities throughout the world, including Santiago, Chile. Now, this is both gay Mormons and straight Mormons. And these Mormons are holding up signs that range anywhere from "Real Mormons love everyone" to "This Mormon mom supports your right to marry." During the San Francisco parade, I was actually joined by NBC, and one of the producers, was with us that day. And she had never really been introduced to Mormons before. And she had a very interesting experience. Later that night, we went to dinner, and she looked at me, and she said, "You know, I have to tell you, I think today may have been one of the most spiritual experiences I have ever had." She said, "With people running into the streets and breaking down the barricades of pride, and that's no easy feat here in San Francisco, to run out to your contingent and hug you and tearfully say, 'Thank you, thank you.'" That really meant a lot. For the first time in history, we have also seen BYU students create a video series, and stand up for inclusion and more active inclusion of their LGBT brothers and sisters, not just in their faith, but in their university, at Brigham Young University. And we've watched as that video series went viral. For the first time in history, we now have evidence-based research that tells Mormon families how to respond to LGBT youth and young people in a way that keeps them safe from significant health risks, including suicide and depression. These materials that are brought to us by the Family Acceptance Project are the only faith-based materials that have been nationally recognized as a best practice in suicide prevention, and they're based on the Mormon faith. We have also seen emergence of a couple of brand new organizations in the past 14 months that are being led by straight traditional Mormons. We have Mormons for Marriage Equality, which is headed by straight Mormons who have kids and have families and think that from a public policy issue, gay marriage should be allowed. And they do exactly what they say they're going to do. They work at a grassroots level in every state where there's a marriage referendum on the ballot. And they have phone banks and they get people out to vote in support of gay marriage. We also have Mormons Building Bridges, which was started by a Mormon mom in Salt Lake City, straight, and that organization aims to essentially open the dialogue between the LGBT community and the Mormon communities. And now, in just a few short months, in Salt Lake City alone, that organization has over 3,000 members. So, you know, as a man of faith, I look at the last 14 months, and as somebody who has such great respect and great reverence for my Savior, I feel like it's almost as if my Savior has his finger on the fast-forward button when it comes to healing between the LGBT and the Mormon communities. And it is a remarkable thing to behold and a very humbling thing to be part of. So with that, I am going to stop my caffeine buzz and sit down and go to the question and answer session.
Thank you, Mitch. For our radio audience, you are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Mormons for Marriage Equality, featuring Mitch Main. Thank you, Mitch, for that very passionate and personal recounting of how you got here. So, as I mentioned earlier, Prop 8 is on the court's calendar, the Supreme Court's calendar. We don't know how they're going to rule. It soon may be history. It soon may continue in litigation. So let's talk a little bit about Prop 8. A lot of press releases around the time of Prop 8 passage pointed the finger towards the Mormon Church for both activating people as voters and also for financial support for Prop 8. Do you know how much money the Mormon Church donated to the Prop 8 campaign?
I do not know how much money the Mormon Church donated to the Proposition 8 campaign. My experience with the Proposition 8 campaign, and I have gone on record to say this, and I will always say this, I think Proposition 8 was one of the most unchristlike things that we have ever done as a Mormon church. One of the things that we stand for as a Mormon faith is the importance of family. And we say over and over again how important these relationships between, you know, our parents and our children and our spouses, how important those relationships are. And yet, we as an organization backed a political referendum that actually pit father against son and mother against daughter. And in my case, spouse against spouse. And we eroded so many families and broke apart so many families, and it was difficult it was difficult to watch us not walk the talk. And I think in large part we deserve the black eye that we got as a supporter of Proposition 8. But the good news is there's a lot of people out there who criticize it, Julian, who criticize the Mormon Church's involvement. But, you know, and I think realistically have cause to be one of those with the losses that I experienced myself. But the reality is I think it unfolded exactly as it was supposed to unfold. Because if Proposition 8 hadn't been the ugly, divisive time that it was, we wouldn't be having this conversation that we're having today.
Well, let's talk about a black eye going the other way. Has the Mormon Church reacted to you coming out publicly and supporting Proposition 8 when it wasn't part of the official thing to do?
Well, actually, no. In fact, if anything, the groundswell of support that I get as, you know, stating that I'm openly gay Mormon, the groundswell of support that I get actually comes from traditional Mormons, straight people, many of whom are, you know, sitting with us tonight. And it's from people who, you know, want to see change on this issue, want to see, you know, inclusion and equality. There has been no, there has been no effect from the church or no reaction from the church from me marching under a banner that says Mormons for Marriage Equality. The important thing to understand, Julian, is there's two things within the Mormon Church that are very distinctly different. One is doctrine, and the second is policy. Our doctrine doesn't say anything about how we vote. Our policy is for LGBT people, we want them to remain celibate, to be active in the church, or we want them to try to change their orientation. Policy and doctrine are two very different things. So we don't, that is our policy, but we also tell people that we are free to vote however we want. So I follow my heart.
So help me understand this. There are six states in America plus the District of Columbia that already allow marriage equality as a matter of law. What is Mormon policy then towards respecting those jurisdictions that already allow same-sex marriage?
What's an interesting and incredible question that is. We do have a set of doctrinal principles we refer to as the Articles of Faith within our church, and one of them states explicitly that we as a Mormon faith will always obey the laws of the land. What will be very interesting to watch unfold is what happens with gay marriage. Gay marriage is really a question of when and not if within the United States. And it will be very interesting to watch and see how the church responds at that point in time to gay marriage. So I'm very much looking forward to that one.
So you've mentioned a few leaders, bishops in your church, who have been very supportive and have initiated groundbreaking, bridge building, et cetera. Are they part of a minority, rogue part of the Mormon Church? Are they going to be disciplined and disappear sometime in the night? Or do they represent a new way of thinking and that could lead to schism in the church?
Well, I think what is very important to also mention here is, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do about doctrine on the ground level where we are, but there is a lot we can do about policy. It is not our policy as a Mormon church to excommunicate LGBT people, even if they're in a relationship with someone of the same gender. Our policy for excommunication is reserved for just those people who commit pretty heinous and horrible crimes that I think almost everyone would agree kind of deserve to be distanced from the religion a little bit. The LGBT issue falls into a list of many, many things that fall under the category of you might be disciplined for. What's happened in the Mormon faith is this tradition of excommunicating LGBT people, whether they be single or whether they be in a relationship or whether they be dating somebody new every night, has just become a cultural norm. And, you know, we've done it over and over and over again to the point where that's just how things have been managed. So really, the truth of the matter is in San Francisco and the Bay Area as a whole, we're not doing anything different except for culturally. We're changing the way the conversation is being held between LGBT people and traditional Mormons. And will these bishops be, you know, swept away in the night by the KGB? I don't believe they will. In fact, if anything, we're seeing an increase of them. Just over the past couple of weeks here, I have gotten three emails from a couple of different bishops and stake high councilmen from around the country. One most recently from the Northwest, a gentleman was called into the stake high council, and he reached out to me immediately and he said, I have been tasked with essentially educating every bishop inside my stake on how to be more welcoming and inclusive of LGBT members. Will you help me? And this is the sort of thing that I'm seeing happening over and over and over again. So, no, there will not be any whisking away in the middle of the night. Will it create a schism in the church? I think that there already is a schism in the church. I think people's hearts are very torn on this issue. I think that we already have that today.
Okay, you made me ask this question, but who told him that he has to be tasked? I mean, who's tasking that bishop with including LGBT people?
That would be his stake president.
And is that a local initiative that is coming up, or is there any connection to the high leadership of the church in Utah?
Well, like all large organizations, how change generally occurs within our faith, or it has traditionally occurred within our faith, is it started with social change. Look at the military. You mentioned earlier the how we no longer have don't ask, don't tell, but actually full acceptance of LGBT members in the military. That became about as a cultural shift in the beginning as well. I don't know if, you know, what is happening in Salt Lake. I don't have a view into that. All I know is what I have an opportunity to do today, and that is help these other local communities as they want to reach out their hands to the LGBT members.
So let's talk about gay pride. So pride is many things to many different people, and you've described that your experience here in San Francisco, marching for Mormons for marriage equality. Now, are you going to be in trouble historically with this? I mean, it was fine for this year, but was that an anomaly, or is that going to be something that can be repeated, and can it be scaled in other communities?
Well, we pretty much have repeated it and have scaled it to over 20 communities throughout the world. And this thing is like a snowball. If 14 months ago, if you would have told me I would be marching in Pride Parade with some of the folks that are sitting here tonight, I wouldn't have believed you. But this, the momentum that this issue is gaining and the welcoming that traditional Mormons want to see inside the faith, I mean, that's not going to go away anytime soon. And what I really want to drive home, Julian, is like this is not, you know, a bunch of radical gay Mormons who are standing up saying, you know, include us. This is being driven largely by, you know, traditional Mormons, by straight Mormons, by heterosexual Mormons who have spouses and families who want to see inclusion, who want to see this go away. So if you want to get rid of this issue, you're going to have to get rid of a whole heck of a lot of Mormons.
Well, let's talk about that, because there seems like for every movement, there's always a counter-movement, the laws of Newtonian physics. So what has been the backlash to you? You've painted a pretty rosy picture, scalable, more and more pride marches, but there certainly has got to be a backlash. And what is that backlash?
I am an eternal optimist. I will give you that, my friend. The backlash, I have not experienced any backlash personally, other than, I do get some strange mail. But I think that comes with any sort of, being in the public eye. There are many Mormons who, you know, err on the traditional side and err on the conservative side and want to see, you know, no gay marriage. But I don't really hear much from them. I'm sure that there are activities, but I'm honestly, my attention is so focused on the good things that are happening that I can't really fill you in on that.
Okay, so tonight we are competing with the vice presidential debates that are happening, and it's no secret that it is election season in the United States. How would you expect the LGBT community to fare under President Mitt Romney? I only read what I'm given.
I'm going to find the person who wrote that question. How would I expect the LGBT community to fare under Mitt Romney? You know, recently I alluded to the fact that I had done some work with NBC, and, you know, we had hours and hours and hours of video. I had gone back to New York a couple times and sat down with them, and we spent several hours just on the political issue alone. And you know, whenever you record anything nowadays, it's like you completely lose control of it, right? So some of it went on Rock Center for with Brian Williams, and other parts of it ended up on NBC, and other parts of it ended up on the web. But the political commentary largely went to MSNBC, and I actually didn't even see it. But, you know, this is National Coming Out Day. I came out as a Democrat on NBC. And coming out as a Democrat in the Mormon community, I think, is as difficult as coming out as a gay person in the Mormon community. So how would I expect the LGBT community to fare under Mitt Romney? You know, as a Democrat, I have to tell you, and just be frank with you, you know, I'm not a politician, I'm not a lawyer, but I know what doesn't feel good to me, and I watch what Mitt Romney does and how he responds to all humans, and it doesn't feel good to me. I don't think any of us, quite frankly, are going to fare particularly well under Mitt Romney, unless we're in the same club as him.
One of the big issues that Caitlin Ryan with the Family Acceptance Project has been working on is acceptance to prevent teens specifically from suicide or other ways of harming themselves. We know that teen suicide rates among LGBT youth are higher than among the general population, and among LGBT Mormons, it's probably even higher. So what is being done, if anything, to address gay or LGBT Mormon youth who are at risk?
That is another great question. And actually, you know, somebody asked me the other day, this is a question that I get quite frequently, is why do you stay? Why do you stay in the Mormon Church at all? Wouldn't it be just easier to walk away? Some days, quite honestly, it would be easier to walk away. But then I look at you know, the letters I get from 14-year-old boys or girls around the world that tell me how they're struggling and how they've seen what I'm doing, and it just gives them just a modicum of hope, Julian, that they really might just be okay just the way they are. So with Dr. Ryan's research, and by the way, the LGBT Mormon youth suicide rate has never been tracked on a scientific basis, largely because there's so much shame and secrecy that enshrouds that concept in the Mormon community, and the irony, of course, being that shame and secrecy are both risk factors that contribute to suicide. But most experts estimate LGBT suicide in the Mormon community to be between 4 and 9 times the national average, which for a faith that puts families first is abysmal. With the launch of this material by Dr. Caitlin Ryan and the Family Acceptance Project, we actually are providing families a way to work within the framework of the faith that does not fly in the face of doctrine today, that helps them deal with kids in a way that is proven to keep them safe. Since we've launched this, I did a launch campaign with Caitlin Ryan and several other Mormon bishops. And I think during the first month of this, Caitlin was averaging a download of this booklet 1 every 5 minutes. And people are reaching out to her from across the United States, from Mormon congregations, to get their hands on this because they realize that what we're doing today doesn't work. The policy that we have for LGBT people and how to deal with them is locked in time, is frozen in a set of concepts and a set of notions from the 1960s and 1970s that really were not based in any sort of science at all. They were based on someone's opinion of what we wish the world would be like. And those concepts are, you can change your orientation, or if you can't change your orientation, then you should sit on it for the rest of your life and not have a full, complete life. Well, today, what we see with the Emergence of Family Acceptance Projects is, you know, we actually have science now and scholarship that tells us how to respond in a way that keeps children safe. So my hope is that this is going to continue to have the great reception that it's had, and the families are going to begin to use it, and the churches as well.
So you've described kind of a grassroots response to it. To what extent, if any, has the Mormon leadership engaged Caitlin Ryan's booklet? or her research?
I actually am not at liberty to comment on Dr. Ryan's research, so I will have to defer that one.
So while we're talking about Mormon youth, the big news this last week was the age of missionaries has dropped for men and for women. And I find it interesting that in the fight for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a lot of it was generational, the attitudes towards LGBT people serving openly among younger troops was markedly different from the older generation with whom they served also. The younger troops had a lot more acceptance, and the older troops had a lot more inertia towards change. So now you've got younger and younger Mormon missionaries that will be going out. Is there going to create some sort of dissonance within the missionary corps because of their generational attitudes, or will the discipline and training of the missionary training center hold and they be absolutely obedient to the tenets of the church, doctrinally, I guess?
Well, I think this idea of things being a generational issue is that's the experience of the human family. I mean, that extends well beyond the military or well beyond the Mormon Church. Will the strict tradition of missionary training centers, will that hold? Well, I got to tell you, I think that you're going to be hard-pressed to find a whole lot of 18, 19-year-old people who really either don't know someone who is gay or don't have a family member who is gay and don't look at this as an issue that's not really an issue. So I think, as that trend continues in society, that's going to eke its way into the Mormon culture as well. And I think we're going to see that, we will always be obedient to the missionary training center and the doctrinal principles to the extent that we can. But there are going to be folks who look at this issue and think that maybe it's one that we need to rethink.
So when we're talking about doctrinal purity or obedience to the tenets of the church, as a temple-sealed Mormon, there is an absolute fidelity to the teachings and the leadership of the church through the apostolic succession. And yet at the same time, there's the personal commitment to the teachings of Jesus Christ that is espoused by your church that calls for loving your neighbor as yourself, radical social treatment that he himself embodied during his ministry. How do you reconcile the two of them when the leadership of the church is not radically inclusive?
That is really an easy one. Hands down, I am always going to stand with my Savior. Hands down. The great thing about being Mormon is, we are counseled that, that we have incredibly wise, smart, kind men in Salt Lake City who genuinely want to do the right thing. But the truth of the matter is, Julian, it's like, let's just look back at 1978 when blacks were first allowed to hold the priesthood. These may be kind, wise, benevolent men who are living in Salt Lake City, but the truth of the matter is most of them really haven't left Utah. And probably they haven't had much of a cause to think about the black experience in America, and certainly not the black experience inside the Mormon Church, until society stood up and poked them on the shoulder hard enough and said, hey guys, you need to think about this. You need to pray about this. I think the same thing is true with the LGBT issue. These guys really do want to do the right thing, but we need to make sure that they're thinking about this. And by raising our hands on a continual basis and making sure that happens, I think we stand an increased chance of seeing that change. But who do I obey? I've often said, Julian, that, the only opinion of me that matters more than my own is that of my Savior. And I'm not saying that to be arrogant. It's just that, any human that I don't put much stock in any human's experience or opinion other than my Savior. It's like he is the one that I answer to at the end of the day. I believe that when I pass this life, there's not going to be a prophet or a bishop or a stake eye councilman or a stake president there to lobby for me in front of my Savior and say, oh, by the way, Mitch really screwed this up, but I told him to, so I hope it's okay. That's not going to happen. It's just going to be me and my Savior. So whatever I do in my life, I better be darn sure that I'm okay with my Savior in it. And I don't really care what anybody else says.
You're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is about Mormons for Marriage Equality, featuring Mitch Main. Mitch, you've talked about how successful you and your bishops and your leadership have been in Berkeley, you know, with crowds exceeding your expectations. So are you really literally preaching to the choir, or what are you doing to reach the larger gay community who has this very negative connotation of Mormons and inclusion, especially LGBT inclusion?
Well, that is another great question. You know, when we first started talking about doing pride parades across the United States, there were two schools of thought. And one of them was, you know, I mentioned earlier Mormons Building Bridges and Mormons for Marriage Equality, two different organizations. And one of the schools of thought was, well, you know, really we need to take a conservative approach here, and let's go out and march in these pride parades with a banner that says Mormons Building Bridges. And my response to that was, you better not do that in San Francisco unless you want a beer bottle chucked at your head. You know, your message as a Mormon marching in Pride Parade needs to be a little stronger than, you know, unicorns and Smurfs. So we came up with the two distinct organizations of Mormons for Marriage Equality and Mormons Building Bridges. The strategy behind Mormons for Marriage Equality was, in those cities that have, you know, suffered a fate like California, San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles, let's go out with a stronger message. In those states where there's a referendum on the ballot or upcoming, let's go out with a stronger message. In the more conservative areas, in the Midwest or in the Intermountain West, let's go out with our Mormons Building Bridges message. Both of those things has resonated very, very well, and both of them have worked well for us. So are we preaching to the choir? Well, I think, Julian, if I would say yes, we are preaching to the choir if our events were limited to Berkeley and San Francisco. But given, you know, that we've marched now in 20 Pride parades all across the world, given the volume of emails that I'm getting from bishops and stake presidencies wanting to get their hands on Family Acceptance Project materials, wanting to understand what we're doing in the Bay Area that's different and how they can emulate that, we're not preaching to the choir. Social media has brought us to a point in society where there aren't any secrets anymore. There really aren't any secrets anymore, and I think that's both a good and a bad thing. And for us, it's actually working in our benefit. This is happening at the very local level all across the country, but it is a groundswell of support, I don't think there's a way we can put the lid back on the box.
So pride parades come once a year, and they tend to be very emotionally high, but then after the high, there's the letdown. What are you doing to sustain that sort of energy? You mentioned circling the wagon meetings that have been happening periodically, but is there now an LGBT-based organization, not a straight Mormon organization, that is a home for people who are queer within the Mormon Church on a year-round basis?
There is a virtual home. Is there a real home? There's not. And that breaks my heart. Because I talked earlier about there's sort of this cultural tradition within the faith to excommunicate gay Mormons, whether they're in a relationship or not. We just sort of hold disciplinary councils on them and excommunicate them. And these people are often, distanced from the faith, you know, and they tend not to come back. Some of them have joined an organization called Affirmation for Gay and Lesbian Mormons, which is for people who, you know, kind of just don't have a home for Thanksgiving. And others of them just kind of flounder. There's not anyone out there, really, Julian, who is raising their hand, aside from these few congregations that I have mentioned, that said, you know what, we don't care what the situation is in your personal life. We want you to be part of our ward family. We want you to be here. So there may not be that organization today of gay Mormons, but the truth of the matter is, Julian, I hope we get to a point where we don't need a separate organization for gay Mormons versus straight Mormons, because these are two communities that, in my heart of hearts, I believe really belong to each other. And I want to see inclusion of both, and I want to see both of them, you know, in the same congregation. I don't want to see that separation.
You had mentioned your heart several times, and you mentioned you got this call and you had to think about it, but I want to drill down on that for a minute. What was it that led you to really come out publicly in such a big way to build the bridges between the two communities, your two communities?
Well, so let's talk about the calling a little bit. I think the first thing that's important to note is that I took this calling under a couple of conditions, and the first condition was that it would be given to me in the identical fashion that it would be given to any heterosexual man. And, you know, I did not commit to a lifetime of celibacy to take this calling. I did not denounce my sexual orientation. I did not say that I'm trying to not be gay. I did it as my full and authentic self. And I did that because that's about parity, and that's about equality, and that's about inclusion, and that's fair. And I have completely forgotten your question. I'm so sorry.
Okay, so it sounds like those are very intellectual things. You're doing it for equality and for parity and a sense of fairness. But what is it within Mitch and your personal history that just made you say, I'm going to give up my good Mormon life and go out there and get these emails? And by the way, thank you for being associated with you, because I've started getting some of those emails too, and it's interesting reading.
They're colorful, aren't they?
They are. And but why set yourself up as a possible target? Why put yourself out there?
Because I look back at my own history, and I've been very open about this. You know, I tried unsuccessfully 5 times to take my own life as a gay Mormon, because I believe that who I was at my core wasn't who God wanted me to be. And I tried and tried and tried to change that part of myself, and I cannot. And now I believe that I'm not supposed to. I took this calling because of the 16-year-old Mitch Main out there, the 15-year-old Mitch Main who tried to take his own life. I see that happening so often, and there's such an opportunity here to, you know, to help these kids and to help the adults who are in what we call mixed orientation marriage, where a heterosexual person has married a homosexual person, and now they have kids. And, you know, I get these emails, too, from the 40-something-year-old dad who realizes, you know what, I'm gay and I've got 4 kids and I can't live this dishonest life anymore. And so now not only have I lost 45 years, but now I'm taking this woman down that I really genuinely do love, and now I've got these 4 kids to think of. What am I going to do with this mess? I'm doing it so that's not going to happen moving forward, or at least not going to happen as much. Part of it is a little bit selfish, Julian, and I have to be honest with that. When I lost my relationship, you know, I'm very Mormon. And when I put that ring on my partner's finger and he put that ring on my finger, that wasn't until something better comes along. And it wasn't until we get mad and we don't want to talk anymore. It was forever. And when I lost that, you know, as a Mormon, we're taught really well about how to make relationships succeed, but we're not ever taught how to make them fail and what to do when they do. And I know that one of the best things that I can do to help heal myself is to serve other people. So some of this is selfishly driven in terms of me wanting to use this as an opportunity to give back to the rest of the community, because the truth of the matter is, Julian, you know, I couldn't do this if I were in a relationship. I couldn't do this if I were still with my partner. The church would not allow me. They would not allow me this opportunity to serve my fellows. And it's not wasted on me that I have the opportunity to literally serve millions of people, but I had to lose. I had to lose the one that I loved the most to do it.
Why would the church not allow you to serve in this capacity if you were partnered?
The church does not allow LGBT Mormons who are in relationships and not living under the policy as we understand it today to serve in official callings.
Okay. So it sounds like in the Bay Area, at least, you're developing a network of stakes and wards that are quite progressive, and people are hearing about it all across the country and reaching out to you. And that's within the church itself. What about interfaith efforts? San Francisco is such a pluralistic society. We have a lot of different faiths here, traditional and non-traditional. And what are you doing to build bridges to people of faith in those communities?
Well, I'm also keenly interested in interfaith stuff. So Maybe I'm like this faith nerd, but one of the things that I really enjoy doing is like going to interfaith celebrations or going to other people's faith practices to see how they recognize and honor, you know, God and how they understand God. And, you know, from doing that, I have developed this really interesting kind of hodgepodge of a spiritual practice that I think of as like diversifying my spiritual portfolio, right? So I have like this stuff that I borrowed from the Buddhist faith and from the Muslim faith and, you know, some stuff from the Mormon faith. So I've, you know, been keenly interested in interfaith stuff for quite some time. I am now working with Michael Pappas as somebody who attends regularly the interfaith breakfast series here in the city, and have begun actually to reach out in a couple of areas, or we have begun to actually reach out in a couple of areas, San Francisco specifically, to partner with Catholics for Marriage Equality for the next Pride celebration. And there was an article that ran in Seattle today about a Jewish rabbi, a Muslim, and a Mormon who are all teaming together to support marriage equality.
It sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. But
it does, doesn't it? It's like you'd expect them to walk into a bar. But it was, you know, that sort of, you know, I think people are able to realize what's important here. And it's not our differences that separate us, but it's our similarities that bind us, I think.
Have you used the medium of internet video to make a series of It Gets Better videos for Mormon youth?
Have I personally? Yes. And have we as this is the great thing about media, again, the double-edged sword of the internet. Yes, there are a bunch of LGBT Mormons out there who are in an It Gets Better series. There's a bunch of straight and allied Mormons out there in an It Gets Better series. The really interesting thing that I think has happened is straight spouses who have married gay Mormons have recently put together a really, really touching and heart-wrenching It Gets Better video that's about 7 minutes long that tells the story of these straight people who went into these relationships many times advised by their spiritual leaders to go ahead, get married, it'll go away, and now these marriages are dissolving. And these straight people actually are needing to hear the message, it gets better, just as much as the gay people are.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one more question. Okay, Mitch, if you were not doing what you're doing with this calling, what else would you be doing with your 24 hours a day?
I think that I would be writing. I've always loved to write, and I would be writing books, and probably bitterly funny ones. So,
Mitch, I want to thank you for your candor and for your touching testimony tonight. It's been a real honor and a pleasure to talk to you. And to our audience here and on the radio, I want to say thank you. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating our 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.